Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the fourth day of Stephen Foster Week. Stephen Foster Week always opens National Stephen Foster Day, which is January 13th, by act of Congress. January 13th was designated Stephen Foster, National Stephen Foster Day. That is the day he died. Now you may say, well, why not his birthday? Well, you forget. He was born on the 4th of July, on the 50th anniversary of our country. And we knew that he'd get lost in the shuffle. And we feel that he should indeed be honored, as he has been here. Many people ask us if this is where he was born, or if he ever saw the river. Well, we know that you know that he was born in Pittsburgh. He's a Yankee. He was a Yankee. But we forgive him for that. And we have no record that he ever saw the Suwannee River. But we think it's highly appropriate to have on the river that he made famous round the world a tribute to him. And it was first conceived by one lady who felt there should be a marker on the river. And it grew. And she gave the idea to the Florida Federation of Music Clubs. And they took it right up. And when the baby got too big for them to handle, they asked the state of Florida to take it over. And the state was very glad to. So it has grown and grown and grown. The idea was conceived in the 30s, but the park was not developed or dedicated until October of 1950. So we've been here and a-growing and suffering growing pains, all kinds of things since that time. Along came a lady who, well, she was the president of the National Federation of Music Clubs. And she felt that the banks of the Suwannee River was an ideal place to have a Florida Folk Festival. And we took that idea up too. And so we have along with Stephen Foster Week, we have an annual Florida Folk Festival, which is 25 years old. Well, that got us interested in folklore. Now, Stephen Foster, of course, was the first American composer to be in the Hall of Fame. And some of his music is passing into the folk category. Although we know that one thing that characterizes folk music is that the composer is usually unknown. I think today it's highly appropriate to have here with us a folk singer, a prestigious folk singer, whose roots are Kentucky. She was born in Vipa, Kentucky. She now lives with her husband, George Spico, in Port Washington, New York. But she is known around the world. And she is like music, like folk music. She's characterized by simplicity. She's the youngest of a family of 14 children who was born in the mountains of Kentucky. And she sings and keeps alive her family heritage of songs and tales. And we are thrilled to be able to present to you the number one lady of folk music of the United States, Jean Ritchie.
Thank you, Cousin Thelma. And all you people that haven't heard Cousin Thelma Bolton tell a tale, you'll have to get her to do that for you sometime. She's a best storyteller I ever heard, I think. My music comes from my family, from the fireside and from the front porch. The family, as Cousin Thelma's told you, was a large one, mom and dad and the 14 children. One child had passed away before I was born, one of the twins, and Jewel and Opal were the twins. The family consisted of mom and dad and May, Ollie, Mally, Uni, Raymond, Kitty, Truman, Patty, Edna, Jewel, Opal, Pauline, Wilmer, and Jean. I'm Jean, and so my sister May is still alive. She's in her 80s and going strong. She makes corn chip dolls, and the whole family makes quilts, and they're in the doll-making business. All of them make corn chip dolls, and mostly just for fun. They do sell them, too, sometimes. And my husband makes dulcimers, and so we are still a folk family. And I have just the most recent thing he's done with his hands making with woodwork has been to build us a log house in Kentucky. So we have now have a Kentucky home again, and I'm very glad about that. I'd like to sing a song for you first that it's the kind of the old-fashioned singing style that my dad and my mother used to do and their ancestors before them. We hadn't any radios in those days and televisions, and just sang our own, made our own music. And that's some of you heard the McLean family yesterday heard a later kind of music, an instrumental form of the same music. Ours was a pre-instrumental kind of music. We didn't have many instruments around, so we just sang. And this old-fashioned kind of decorated style is the way that my father would sing as he went up to milk the cow or walked around in the outside. And this song is called, it's a love song, it's called A Little Lonesome Dove. As I walked out one cold winter's night, a drinking of sweet wine, conversing with a neat little girl who promised she'd be her cheeks were like some pink of the rose that blooms in the month of June. Her voice was like some new instrument that has just been put in tune. Says I to her, I'm a going away to some far off domain, and when my fortune's won and made, then I'll surely come back again. 10,000 miles away from home, through England, France, and Spain, this poor body till you come back again. Supposing you was taken down sick and you so far from home, oh, who would hear your loudly cries or bear your pitiful moan? Hush up, my love, don't break my heart, for I hate to see you cry. The best of friends must oftentimes part, and now it's you and I. Oh, don't you see that little lonesome dove flying from pine to pine, weeping for him and true love, just like I'll weep for mine. I asked my dad a lot, used to wonder a lot about why he did that at the end of a song. It kind of changed the last line of tune, and then you drop his voice down. And I finally got up my nerve. You know, you didn't talk to your daddy. You didn't say just any old thing to your daddy. You had to. He was the one that disciplined the whole family, and you kind of thought before you spoke to him. But I got up my nerve and asked him one time, why do you do that on the end of a song? He said, well, it's the end of the song, and you put a period on it. You let everybody know it's over. And that satisfied me at the time. Later on, when I went to looking for the sources of the family songs over in England and Scotland and Ireland, I had a Fulbright scholarship, went over there collecting songs one time, and I noticed the bagpipes would do that at the end. When you stop blowing into the Scottish pipes and you stop playing them, they go, ugh. So I thought, maybe that's what the voices in Kentucky were doing. They didn't have any pipes to play, and they didn't have any instruments to accompany the song, so the voice had to accompany the song and fill in the gaps at the end of the line. And when you got to the end, the voice would drop at the end, just like the pipes drop at the end of their tunes. So that's another theory, and I don't know which is which. Anyway, the only instrument we had to play, besides whistles and things like that, was, let me move this over a little bit, was the dulcimer, and we had that came into the mountains, my part of the Appalachia, about, I guess, 1870, somewhere of, old Edward Thomas was born about 1850, just 1850 he was born, or maybe a little before, but he started making dulcimers as a young man. So it would be when he was in his late teens, I guess, around 1860, between 1865 and 70. And everybody around, he made dulcimers for everybody around. Everybody got one of his dulcimers. And he, as far as we know, was the first man to start making them. My dad got one of his, and can't remember him. When he was alive, he could remember Ed Thomas coming around with his little cart with dulcimers hanging all around the frame. You know, had a little frame built around the cart, a little hand cart. He pushed it by hand. And he had a little frame around the top, and he had dulcimers hanging all around, you know, just straight up and down like this, banging against each other. You'd think they would have all got broken up, but they were pretty sturdy instruments. And he'd take one, he'd meet somebody in the road, and he'd take it down and get his chair off the back of the cart and say, wait a minute now, whoever you are, I want to play you a tune. He knew most everybody. Once in a while, I guess he met somebody he didn't know. And so he'd sit right there in the road on his chair and play his dulcimer, or he'd sit on the edge of the bank or something. And then he'd try to sell them a dulcimer, and that's the way he made his living. Sometimes a man would have a little money. He'd say, well, I can give you $3 or $4 for it. That was a big money back then, you know, so he would buy it. Or he would say, I don't have any money, but I can take you home with me and put you up for the night and feed you good chicken and dumpling supper. So the man would say, well, that's pretty good. So he made his living. He got around that way and sold dulcimers and traded them and everything. And Dad had one. Dad would often sit with his dulcimer in the... after work in the evening, or on rainy days when he couldn't go out to the cornfield in the summertime and sit and play. And this is a tune that I'm going to play for you, a tune we used to tease him with. He was a shoemaker. That is, he had to mend up our shoes around... November, when people were having to put shoes back on to go to school, he would get the last stand out from behind the door and the last and start cobbling, and he would put half soles and heels and full soles and uppers, and you know, with that big a family, you had to mend everybody's shoes, and the younger ones had to wear the older people's shoes. So this is a shoemaker song. And when Dad was cobbling, us children would get around and kind of tease him with this song. Tell him what it all today and come again tomorrow. belly all a riddle. Her tongue is loosened at both ends and tied up in the middle. Oh, all about do I fall. Oh, nice and radio. Oh, no, do I fall. Fighting back in the hatch. Oh, woman, if you don't hold your tongue, you're stoned and you're beaten. I'll tan your hide and make my shoes and wear you out to meet. No, all about do I fall. Oh, no. You can come on in. Oh, I see. That might be fun since it is a Stephen Foster week. And last year I didn't sing any Stephen Foster songs, but I thought maybe I might sing one just the way my mother sang it around the house, in the old-fashioned style. It's a little bit different from the way you usually hear it. Not much, but a little bit. And of course the one she knew the best was the most famous one. So I'll just do you a verse of that in honor of Stephen Foster. Old folks at home, or the Suwannee River. She'd be going sweeping or working around the house, and she'd be singing. And this is one of the songs that she had learned from the older girls who'd gone off to school and come back to settlement schools and things like that, and they'd picked up Stephen Foster songs. Way down upon the Suwannee River, far, far away, there's where my heart is turning ever. All up and down the whole creation, sadly I roam, still longing for the old plantation and for the old folks at home. All the world is sad and dreary, everywhere I roam. Oh, darkies, how my heart grows weary, far from the song is very important to people, like just like the old sort of laments, love laments and the old real folk songs, because it expressed, it made you feel, it was a song you could lean on when you really wanted to feel sorry for yourself or express your sadness in some way or the hardships of life. Retuning here a little bit for a ballad song. This is a song that tells a story. A ballad in folk music means a song with a plot, you know, with characters and things happen to them, and usually they all got killed off in the end, got their heads chopped off, or they died for love or something like this. This one was a happy one, one of the few happy ones. It had a good ending, and that was important to me when I was a little girl. I liked things that came out happy. And still do. So here's a song that had a good ending. My mother, though, always had a word of caution about the song. She said, "Well, girls, the woman in this story, this is not what my mother said. This is what the woman in the story, the hero, the heroine, dressed up like a man and sailed on the sea searching for her sweetheart. And my mother didn't approve of that kind of actions by girls, and so she would always caution us that, well, girls, you can sing the song, but don't do likewise. So this is Jethro. There was a rich old merchant in London, he did well. He had one only daughter, the truth to you I'll tell. The truth to you I'll tell. She had sweethearts aplenty, they courted both day and night. About an 18th century form of the song, I guess. This one goes back further. It's a song about a farmer and his mean old wife, and she's supposed to be the meanest woman in the world when the old people tell the story about it. And the third person in the story is the devil. And This we call the song The Little Devils because the verses about the little devils, I guess, tickled everybody around home more than the old devil verses did. But they called it The Little Devils. He's an old daddy devil with some little devils. But anyway, this was a song where the woman had been alive. The farmer and his wife had been living a long time, and the devil decided it was time to take her on home. So he come after her, and the song then tells all about what happens that day to the devil. And Dad would always say, "This is a you girls, you've changed the song, because on the end it's supposed to say, where you say better, it's supposed to say worser." So we'd usually pull this song on my father in the cornfield when we were all out there hoeing. You know, we had corn steep hillsides like this, and the houses were down by the branch in the creek, or by the creek, you'd say, where the water was. But if we had the farm up on the hillside, so we'd clear out a new ground, and the rows went around like that for about half a mile around the hillside and back. And it was a hot and hard place to work, a lot of rocks and stumps and things to fatten. And my dad was very strict on us, as I say, and he thought work was the way you got to heaven. So we worked very hard to justify our existence. And well, sometimes we'd like to get a little longer rest time. So in the cornfields, Dad would let us rest about at the end of when we hoed about two rounds, which would be all the way out and all the way back, and then all the way out and all the way back. Two rounds with maybe 10 children hoeing at the same time is a whole lot of rows. And so he would let us rest a little bit at the end of that, and somebody would go down to the spring, get some water, and we'd have all take a drink of spring water and sit around and fan and try to beat the bees off yourself and the dust. And so we watched my father. He had a hoe with a long, you know, we use the long handle hoes, and he would sort of be sitting there holding his hoe and striking around at the weeds and resting himself. And we all knew the signal when he put his two hands on the hoe and started pushing on it that he was going to get up and go back to work. When you get older, you need a little help. You know, you don't just spring up, you sort of push up on the hoe. Well, the boys got starting songs on him when you do that, and he wouldn't sit still for a ballad. We found that out, and he wouldn't sit still for a hymn. But if we sung a funny song, he would ease back down and act like he hadn't started to get up in the first place, and let us finish the song, and that way we got a little more rest time. So this was one of the ones that he liked, even though the girls would all out shout him on the end where the part came about the moral of the song. The girls, but there was more girls in the family than boys, and so it was easy to holler them down. There was an old man, he lived near hell. He had a little farm and a bonnet did dwell, sang hi a rattle ding day. Oh, the devil come to him one day at his plow. There's one in your family I have to have now, sang hi a rattle ding day. Oh, it's neither your son nor your daughter I crave. It's your old scolding wife, and it's her I must have, sang hi, oh, rattle-ding-day. So he hobbled her up all on his back, and like a bold peddler when a pack in his pack, sang hi, oh, rattle-ding-day. Well, as they drew near the high gates of hell, says, rake back the coals, boys, and we'll roast her well, sang hi, oh, rattle-ding-day. Oh, two little devils come rattling their chains. She hauled back her cudgel and knocked out their brains, sang hi, oh, rattle-ding-day. Then two more little devils peeped over the door. She hauled back her cudgel, killed 99 more, sang hi, oh, rattle-ding-day. Then two more little devils peeped over the wall. Says, take her back, Daddy, or she'll kill us all, sang hi, oh, rattle-ding-day. So he hobbled her up all on his back, and like a bold peddler went a pack in their back, sang hi, oh, rattle-ding-day. Here's your old scolding wife, and it's her I won't have. She ain't fit for heaven, she shan't stay in hell, sang hi, oh, rattle-ding-day. Oh, it's 7 years going and two coming back. She called for the backer she left in the crack, sang hi, oh, rattle-ding-day. You know, the women, they are so much better than men. And they go to hell, they get sent back again, sing hi, oh, rattle-ding-day.
Thank you.
sing you just a verse of one of our hymns. I know Cousin Thelma likes for me to sing the hymns. And these are, my mother and dad belonged to the Old Regular Baptist Church. The Old Regulars were kind of like, you probably the nearest thing, is there any Old Regular Baptists in the room? There's some, the nearest thing to it, I guess, is a Primitive Baptist, what you know as Primitive Baptist. A very old-fashioned church, and they didn't have any pianos or organs or any kind of music, mainly because there wasn't any in the community, I guess, when they started the church. But it got to be the way to do it. You know, the customs got set, and the way of preaching and the way of praying and the way of doing things got to be very ritualized, and nobody ever had the nerve to change anything because they figured that it was the right way to do it, so they just didn't change it. So the old way of singing was preserved for many, many years, and they still sing that way down there. They don't have any songbooks. The church is usually a small room, and there's about this many people in the congregation. And the song leader is the only man or only person that has a book. And he's got the words in front of him, and he doesn't have any tunes written down. No one can read the music anyway, or couldn't in the old days. So at the top of the song it says common meter or sharp meter or long meter or tens and elevens or sixes and sevens or whatever the meter might be, and it's up to him to choose a tune to go with that set of words. So he does, and the way he does it is that he starts singing the first line, and then by the time he gets to the second line, everybody knows what tune he's using, and they know they've got the tunes all in their heads. So then he gives out the second line, or he lines out the second line. And then everybody sings that. And then he lines out the third line and so on all the way through the song. So they know what's coming next and they don't have to have books. And they still do it that way. They still have printed books for everybody. Even though everybody can read now. Most everybody anyway. But here's a verse of one of those songs. I'll do Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah. That seems to be my favorite anyway. And we did Sweet Rivers last night. I'll do a great job. Guide me, O thou great Jehovah, pilgrim through this barren land. Joined when she was 18, and my father joined when he was 85. And it was a long, long time. She had to work on his soul. But he was a good man, though. Yeah, I've heard him tell her many times, Abby, I know as much doctrine as any of them preachers do, and I don't ever hurt anybody. Why do I have to go through all that rigmarole? Mm-hmm. And, which meant, you know, walking down the aisle and going down into the river and getting baptized and all that. But she said, well, that's just the way you've got to do it. After a while he did, but he did hold out for a while. I want to do a few children's songs for you. Yeah. We had, every once in a while, a preacher would come through, a new preacher would come into the community, and he would see our Saturday night parties. You know, that by that time we had fiddles and we had banjos when I was coming along. And I had the fiddle pretty early. When my father was a boy, he saw his first fiddle and made one when he was 17. And that was the first, and he made one out of a gourd, you know, and he played Shady Grove and all kinds of tunes for dancing at the parties. And they didn't call it dancing, they called it running sets. And sometimes, but when a new preacher would come into the community, he would say, I get up in this pulpit on Sunday and he would preach and he would say, look, these children are out in there dancing. And, you know, that's dancing. That's, you know, you call it running sets, but that's the dance. That's the sin. And, you know, they're putting their arms around each other's waist and all those things. And so he would, then the young people would have to quit dancing, put the fiddles away and put the banjos away. And the dulcimers and everything. And what they'd do, they made up songs like, Charlie's neat and Charlie's sweet and Charlie he's a dandy, you know, and I'm goodbye girls, I'm going to Boston, all those things they used to know as children. They brought them out and they made more complicated steps to them, and they would just swing the girl with a two-hand swing and sing the song and clap their hands, and they just did their dances right on. And but as long as they did that and didn't have the fiddle, they called it playing games instead of running sets. And they fooled the preacher. He thought that was all right. And, well, games is, he couldn't say playing games was wrong unless it was on Sunday. So he wouldn't. And after a while, after he'd been there for a month or two, while that we'd get him educated, and he'd say, well, I guess the fiddle's not so bad. I guess the banjo's not so bad. It's not so different, you know. So he'd get in and do the square dances and sit running with us, and it would be all right. So he saved us, and we saved him a little bit both ways. But even when the worst, the hardest ban was on dancing, the strictest preacher in the world, my mother said, they always let us play kissing games. And I said, well, that's peculiar, because if he was so strict, why did he let you play kissing games? Well, she said, it was well chaperoned, and the preachers and the old folks, they all joined in, and everybody had a good time. So this was I'll sing two little kissing games. Now, one is really a children's game that I used to play on the ground at recess with all the other little girls. Little boys wouldn't be caught dead playing a kissing game. They were off shooting marbles in the corner. And the little girls, though, about six, seven, eight, nine, around in there, would all ring up in the springtime and play their little games. And one of them was called Jenny Put Your Kittle On, which was a kissing game. Now, they would choose, it was one in the middle, and she would choose another girl. And sometimes she'd call it by her right name, and sometimes she would cast her eyes over at the little boys shooting marbles and call her by the boy's name, you know, that she liked. She'd call, maybe her name was Mary, but she would call her Johnny when she named him in the song. And, well, the little boys would all holler and scream and push Johnny over in the dirt, and he would get up and fight him. And, you know, that's the way they courted when they real little girls were more advanced than boys always are.
Yeah.
then when the second song I'll just sing right after it is a slower one. And the reason it's slower is because it was played by the courting couples, and they slowed the tempo down to make the kiss last a little longer. This is, and that's called, let's see, Green Grows the Willow Tree. That's two games, that's a game my mother played when she was young. Jenny, put your kettle on, little and a big one. Jenny, put your kettle on, we'll all take tea. Slice bread and buttermilk's good enough for anyone. Choose one you love best, call them on the floor. Oh, dear Johnny, how I love you. Nothing on earth, a love like I love you. My heart you have, and I give you one sweet kiss, and then I leave you. Mwah. Jenny, put your kettle on, little and a big one. Jenny, put your kettle on, we'll all take tea. Slice bread and buttermilk's good enough for anyone. Choose one you love best, call them on the floor. Oh, dear mommy, how I love you. Nothing on earth, a love like I love you. My heart you have, my hand I give you. One sweet kiss, and then I leave you. Green grows the willow tree. Green grows the willow tree. Come, my love, that used to be, and set you down upon my knee. Green grows the rushes, oh. Green grows the rushes, oh, kiss her quick and let her go, for yonder stands her peppy, oh. Well, everybody makes up songs, and children, I think, are the ones that do it the best and the easiest. If you don't interfere with them too much and try to teach them how to do it, they'll do it on their own. And this I did that when I was little and changed things and made up things and so on. But I sang mostly when I got older. I began to sing more of the songs that were handed down in the family. And of course, those had been changed by everybody too. So it was easy and natural for me to do that. The first song I ever really made up, though, I think, although it has, the tune is a very familiar one, you'll see, it's been going on for hundreds of years, little bits of the tune. But we made this up, my boys and I, when the boys were about 6 and 2, they're 4 years apart. They're 23 and 19 now. So anyway, this was the first song I ever actually, wrote or composed. And it happened one time, I think my best compositions are happen when there's a situation comes along and there's no song to fit it, and I just do one in order to be able to sing about it. Well, this is a bedtime song and a children's song. It's the first one that I ever made up with the boys. And it happened one night when I went in. You know, bedtime is a funny thing. It can last 15 minutes or it can last 3 hours, depending on the circumstances and how people feel. And it can be one more drink of water and one more song and one more story, or it can be another round, one more drink of water and one more song and one more story, two more drinks of water, two more stories. If there's two of them, each one of them has to have, you know, equal time. So this was going on one night, and it lasted pretty long, and I thought, well, I was about to go to sleep. I was just about asleep. You know, Mom usually goes to sleep before the children do in most cases. And anyway, it was turning out very well. And I thought, well, it's been long, but it's been a nice bedtime. I've enjoyed it. So I got up and I was tiptoeing out the door. And one of the little voices hollered back through the door. And one crack of the door, I heard one of them say, "What's the prettiest thing you ever saw, Mommy?" And I went back in because I remembered what it was. And I told them a little story that had no ending about when I was a little girl, I was under an apple tree one springtime, the first apple tree that bloomed in Dad's orchard, which consisted of about 4 or 5 trees out in the back hillside. And it was such a warm, pretty day. You know, we have cold winters in Kentucky, colder than down here. And it's always a great celebration when the first warm days come and things start blooming. And there I was under that tree and enjoying the blossoms and the blue sky and the warmth and everything. And all of a sudden there was a darkness over the tree and a funny noise, and I thought the storm was coming up. But what it was a whole lot of bluebirds, maybe 100, maybe more, that were flying by, and they decided to rest in that tree, and they all came fluttering down in among the blossoms. And it was so beautiful that even as a little girl, it made an impression on me, and I remembered it. But what made me remember it more was I ran in and told Mom about them. As soon as they flew away, I said, "Mom, you know what I saw? You know what I saw?" And I was telling her, and she said, "Did you count them?" And I said, "How do I count that many birds? I can just count to 10. So she said, "Well, you count them like this." And she showed me a little counting rhyme that you could use when you saw birds like that. You have to be all the same color, all red or all blue, but a flock of birds. And when they light, you start counting. You say that rhyme over and over and over. And when they rise and fly, whatever you're saying is your fortune. Well, I thought that was a great idea, and I ran back out and sat under the tree all the rest of the day, and I didn't see another bird. And the next day I did the same thing. And after about a week, my mom said, "Honey, don't be too disappointed, because it was, you know, maybe sometimes it's just given to human people to see something that beautiful once in a lifetime. It's a once in a lifetime thing." So far it's been, and I told the boys, the story has no ending. I've never seen them again. But they liked the story, and they made me tell it again next night and next night and next night and next night. And finally, after about 2 weeks, it got a rhyme and a tune, and we were singing it. And we've been singing it. The boys still, they're a little bit embarrassed about it now, but they'll teach it to their children someday. Here it is, the Bluebird Song. When I was a young thing, once on a day, dreaming under my apple tree, a great flock of bluebirds sailing through the sky, espied my tree as they passed by. And oh, it was a wonderful sight to see when they settled down to rest in my apple tree. Count them, said my mother. How? Said I. Out of the window came this reply. One, you'll have sorrow. Two, you'll have joy. Three, get a present. Four, get a boy. Five, receive silver. Six, receive gold. Seven's a secret that's never been told. Eight, a love letter with promises. Three, nine means your true love's as true as can be. Only once in a lifetime, the old folks say, the vision of the bluebirds will come your way. But only if you're dreaming, only if you're still, only in an apple tree on a green hill. So stop all your hurrying and worrying away, and take time for dreaming on a sunny day. Wait for the bluebirds when they come along. Tell your fortune with a bluebird song. Boys can say it like this. One, you'll have gladness. Two, you'll have strife. Three, get a present. Four, get a wife. Five, receive silver. Six, receive gold. Seven's a secret that's never been told. Eight, a love letter with promises. Three, nine means your true love is true as can be. This is a later song that Kentucky, in eastern Kentucky particularly, it's particularly bad. We have a thing called strip mining now with the coal, getting the coal out, and it used to be all deep mining, and there's bad things about deep mining too. There's black lung and accidents and so on. Well, you still can have bad accidents with strip mining too, but the worst thing that happens is to the hills. Because they are so steep, when you try to get the coal out with big machinery, which they're doing today, with bulldozers and augers and earth movers and so on, the whole people's land is just completely destroyed. They come to the top first, and they take the top seam out. And for years, they didn't have any regulations, and they could just throw everything over the sides, and all the land underneath, and particularly the waters. The branches and the streams and the creeks and everything were all silted up, and all the life in them died. The chemicals ran down and too fast and killed the fish, all the fishes and minnows and crawdads and all those little things. There was no life in the stream. So that worried me a lot. I think this song is about 15 years old now. And they could do that to you because about 80 years ago or so, the coal companies like Bethlehem Steel and so on came down and bought up everybody's mineral rights. They knew what was under the ground, and the people didn't. So they sort of came down and said, well, we might want to get that coal out someday. We'll give you 50 cents an acre. And they did that. They gave everybody 50 cents an acre for their mineral rights. So now we own this much land on the surface, and everything underneath belongs to the coal companies, companies that bought them. And they also bought the rights to all the minerals, which means gas and salt water and any minerals that may be discovered in the future. So this is the problem we have there now. And we're fighting to try to keep the hills, they're beautiful mountains, we try to keep them from being destroyed. So this song is called Black Waters. I come from the mountains, Kentucky's my home, where the wild deer and the black bear so lately did roam. By cool rushing waterfalls, the wildflowers dream, and through every green valley there runs a clear stream. Now there are scenes of destruction. scenes of destruction on every hand. Like waters run down through the land. Oh, the quail, she's a pretty bird, she sings a sweet time. In the roots of the tall timber, she nests with her young. Sing a song about home. Everybody who composes songs does eventually gets around and around to write the song about his home. It's a great subject, and I feel very happy about my home, even though it's been wrecked by, well, much of it's been wrecked by strip miners. We built a, Cousin Thelma saw the pictures of our new old log house. We found some old square hand-hewn logs that belonged to relatives' houses from the old days. They're about 150 years old, I guess, or so, but they're still beautiful silver gray poplar logs, all about, you know, about this wide, and some of them are 18 inches you know, this way, are, and they're about 35 feet long. They're from virgin timber, beautiful old logs, and we put them together in a house right just up on the hillside from where I was born, and we can look down on the roof of the house where I was born, so it's a nice thing to think about going back to. And we figure we'll do that. We'll go back there and spend at least some time, half the time. My husband is a city boy, but he's agreed to live part-time down in Kentucky, so we're going to have to go back and forth, I guess, for a while until I can get him educated more. And, so we have a house there, and we want to stay there and try to take care of the rest of what's left of the hills and our land and so on. And this song, though, says more than that. It says, well, I'll tell you the story of how I happened to, after many, many years of having this memory in my mind of writing a song. My mother, when I was 17, sort of stood me up in front of her and sort of turned me around and looked me up and down, and then she began to giggle. and life. And I said, what is the matter? Do I look funny? And she said, well, no, not exactly. She said, but when I was 17, I was just thinking that when I was 17, I was getting married, and you're just a baby. And I said, well, I'm not neither. And she said, you can't get married anyway until you're older, because people don't do that anymore. But I imagine her mother said the same thing, you know, when she was 17. Her mother didn't want her to get married that young either, but she did, and thought it was all right. And she raised all those children, and it wasn't easy. It was a hard life. She and my father were very happy together, though. They managed and survived and lived by the rules of the time. They couldn't change anything, so they lived with it and made it all right. But she told me that on her 17th birthday, not on her 17th birthday, but when she was 17, she had her wedding. And I said, tell me about your wedding day. So she said, well, she was bashful for a few minutes. And then she said, well, I'll tell you the first thing that happened on my wedding day. I got up before sunrise and I went across that river down yonder. And that was the little North Fork of the Kentucky. And I went over on that hillside where the rhododendrons bloom, and I gathered a big armload of rhododendrons to carry at my wedding. They were going to get married out in the yard, and she'd had a pretty dress made. Her pa had brought her some dimity, and she had a pretty dimity dress made with ruffles and, you know, tucks and everything like that. But no one thought to give her any flowers, and one of her friends had told her that the more flowers you carry at your wedding, the happier you'll be. So she said, I was just a staggering under them flowers. When she came back across, and she had to wade across the river. There was a shoal, and she could pick her way across on the rocks, and then sometimes she'd have to lift up her skirt and wade over. And it gave me, even though I didn't see the scene, it gave me a memory to put in my brain, because she was a beautiful woman all of her life. When she was in her 80s, 90s, people were still telling her, Abby, you're prettier than every girl you got. And it was true. And she had long brown hair when she was young, brown eyes, and very different looking from me. I got my coloring from my father. But my mother was really a beauty. And I thought, when she was 17 and that whole bunch of flowers, that must have been such a pretty picture in the early morning mist. And so I remembered it all those years. And then later on, after I got started making up things, I honored my mother and father by writing a song for them. And this is the song called The High Hills and Mountains. Thank you. little short one to end with. This is a song that a lot of people made up. Of course, folk music is like that too. Many, many, many hundreds of people can sometimes have worked on a song that you just take for granted when you sing, like Barbara Ellen. There's so many different variants of that. But this one, I think, started out.